Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We've got an unusual show tonight. We have a show for kids, but you know, the adults are going to learn just as much more as the kids, and we're going to be speaking with John Alcock, and his book is 40 Things I Wish I Told My Kids, Mindful Messages About Success, Happiness, Leather, Pickles, and the Use and Misuse of Imagination. So this is going to be a great show for everybody to learn from. So sit back, relax, take some notes. And if you're so moved afterwards, go out and get that book, because it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, every place you can buy a book, you're going to find this book. And it's going to be truly mind-opening. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through the blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release your BS that is holding you back. But I always ask the question, and that is, are you ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third-generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, The Men and Money Book, and Masterful Choices, The Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life to the absolute fullest. My clients say that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, go to my website, MonicChapman.com. I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn. And you can also sign up for my opt-in newsletter, Intuitive Living. And again, that's on my website, MonicChapman.com. 40 Things I Wish I Told My Kids is about being a successful human being and living a happier, more meaningful life. It contains the important things parents wish they had been able to teach their kids but couldn't because they never learned them or they learned them later on in life. My guest tonight, John Alcock, is the Director of Mindfulness and Chair of the Board of Directors at Sea Change Preparatory, a mindfulness-based school in Del Mar, California, and has been the principal architect of a mindful curriculum there. And he's also a litigator at GLA Piper, LLC, and this is based down in the San Diego area. Welcome, John.
Thank you. How are you today?
I am great. How are you?
I'm great.
Good. It's the first time I've interviewed a litigator, so be easy with me, okay? absolutely love the book, The 40 Things I Wish I Told My Kids. As I was going through it, I was like, and there was sirens going by. As I was doing this, I was wishing I had this advice as a young child because it gives so much information that I feel is pertinent right now, today, for our kids. Why this book and why now?
Well, the book came about because I was going through a challenging time in my life. It was back in 2008 and at 7, and I turned to mindfulness. I went to quite a number of lectures, went to retreats, read dozens of books on the subject, and I found it quite worthwhile. And I wanted to teach what I was learning to my kids, but I couldn't find a book that I thought laid out what I was learning in a clear, concise manner, understandable to a Western audience, a Western audience of teenagers, which they were then, or a Western audience of any age, frankly. So I started writing emails on Father's Day of 2009 from a London hotel room. After 150 emails, during which time the kids said to me, "Dad, you should, you know, turn this into a book," I decided I would. And so that's what I did.
Well, it's interesting. You said 150 emails, and coming from a metaphysical background, any time that you create something and you list 150 items, it comes into being. So I guess you were, you know, creating and not necessarily knowing it at that point, but your kids knew it. So
Yeah, I had in mind maybe it would end up being a book someday, but that wasn't my primary purpose.
Okay. Now, you know, mindfulness is such a buzzword right now. Give us your definition of mindfulness so that everybody's clear.
Right. So the way I think about it, it's paying attention to our present moment experience, internal and external, in such a way as we're not captured by that experience, but rather we can look at it without judgment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, boy, that's a tall leap. You know, those of us who are over 60, we were basically brought up in a mindfulness era where, you know, you needed to not pay attention to anything. It was kind of like gliding through life. And mindfulness embraces so much with the changes that are going on in the world right now. Why does every mind need mindfulness? Not everybody, but every mind.
Right. Well, you know, this approach that I suggest has been around for a very, very long time. And our current society is so dependent upon externals for everything, for our happiness, for occupying our time, occupying our attention, even making decisions. And mindfulness tries to step back from that and use the reflective side of our being to choose wiser intentions to inform our being and our actions rather than a sort of reactive approach to what the external Western culture is kind of dictating to us, is the way I would think about it.
Okay. Now, in your book, the very first chapter is "Don't be ruled by the tyranny of events." What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like what I was saying. In the standard Western culture, people's happiness they allow it to be dictated by external events. So the stock market goes up, they're happy. It goes down, they're sad. They drive to work in the morning, they get unexpected traffic, they're frustrated or angry. Somebody cuts them off, they're angrier still. And we are very reactive to external events, and we let our mind states be dictated by them. And kind of what mindfulness allows you to do is to escape that reactive trap and to look at your experience in a non-judgmental fashion, create a space between the event, be it internal or external, and our reaction or response to the event so that we can choose a wiser response. I mean, we don't really need to be frustrated by traffic. After all, we're sitting in a very comfortable vehicle with the most modern of communications available, with more entertainment available to us in that vehicle than has historically been available to people for the last 100 years. But somehow we're frustrated. It's not because of the situation. It's because of our unskillful response to the situation.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that you brought up the modern communication and the entertainment, because everybody these days, or almost everybody, has a smartphone. Okay. And I feel that smartphones, or cell phones in general, are really taking away from us in our ability to be mindful because there's such a distraction all the time. So how do we bring our children back? I've got two millennials, and my goodness, they're walking down the street texting and whatever, and I'm like, you know, watch out for the car. And they don't seem to get it. Their excuse is, oh, Mom, I'm a millennial. And I'm like, well, no, that's not really an excuse, but that's what they chose to give me. So how can we still utilize the technology that we have at hand, not talking about for the teenagers and the, you know, maybe even up to about 35 or 40. How can we still utilize that entertainment communication but not have it consume us?
Right. I mean, that's really the whole point of mindfulness. It's mm-hmm. the ability to not be captured by our external events or environment. In the case that you are bringing up, it's an excellent one. Cell phones, the video games on cell phones, mm-hmm. the mythical feeling of closeness by Facebook. You know, all of those things are external events that threaten to capture our attention and take it away from things that are much, much more valuable. And so the basic tenet of mindfulness is to develop an approach of dealing with the world, whether it's your cell phone or whether it's the person driving next to you in the car or whether it's your boss, dealing with our environment in a way where we're choosing wise intentions and actions, as opposed to being captured by habit or automaticity with the external events.
Okay. So when we are in a, well, what gets us to the state of mindfulness? Let's go there first. Is it meditation? Is it just being quiet? What can bring us to a state of being mindful?
Well, you know, it's one example I like to give is it's a little bit like riding a bike, right? So you're in Northern California. I'm in Southern California. And say we wanted to learn how to ride a bike. It would not be wise for us to start our learning process at the top of Lake Tahoe Mountain or the top of Mammoth Mountain on a steep downhill terrain and say, okay, let's see if we can ride a bike and learn how to ride a bike on this, you know, 75-degree downward angle. And that is some of the state of our lives. You know, when we're in that traffic situation, when we're dealing with the boss who's angry at us, when we're dealing with the stock market collapsing around us, you know, that's sort of like the downhill 75-degree mountain. However, sitting in a quiet room with less distractions, training your attention using your breath, because that's, after all, something that's always with you. It's a handy thing to use for a training tool, is a way to train your attention, similar to riding a bike on a flat surface with someone helping you. Using training wheels is a good way to learn how to ride a bike. So while mindfulness does not automatically equal meditation, meditation is a very useful tool to train ourselves to not be reactive to our environment, to not be captured by these stories that come into our head or these external events like a cell phone that tend to capture us, and to have a situation where we can create a pause. And in that pause, we can choose where to deliver our attention and what intentions to select. And that's where we find our freedom.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about intentions in a moment, but you talked about breath, the role of breath, and you might as well use it since we have it. You and your wife, Cheryl, created a curriculum for mindfulness for your school, the C College Preparatory, down there in San Diego. How do you work with the children to get them to breathe correctly or breathe in a way that is going to assist them besides just staying alive?
So three mornings a week, we meet down by the ocean. Sea Change is about 300 yards from the Del Mar 15th Street Beach.
Oh, and the, can I be a student?
A lot of people ask me that, and so the kids and some of us adults accompanying them actually swim in the open ocean 3 days a week for about an hour three times a week, and I'll get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But before that, we sit in a circle on the grass above the beach. And we practice guided, mindful meditations. And they are along the lines of what I've just described. You sit, you get into a comfortable posture, and we have the students, and this is fourth graders through seniors in high school, practice paying attention to their breath, and various guided meditations will cause them to focus on other aspects of their experience, but then bring their attention back to the breath. So, for example, there's trains down there, there's ocean sounds, there's bird noise, and so we'll cause the students to focus on those things, but then to retrain their attention back to the breath. And then we'll go into thoughts. You sit there and thoughts about your brother throwing a eraser at you will come into your head, thoughts about what homework you're going to have to do, thoughts about the ocean water is going to be cold when you jump into it in a little while. We'll have them explore the fact that those thoughts was there, but then realize that they can turn their attention away from the thoughts that enter their head and back to their breath, and so on with emotions and feelings and body sensations. And so we have a program where over the course of a year, we train in concentration techniques and mindful meditation. And then the training continues when they jump in the water. Because after all, you have to breathe when you swim. Mm-hmm. And so when they're trying to go out to a half-mile marker and the waves are particularly choppy or there may be seals around, you pay attention to your breath and use it to be a source of determination. So by the time they get to school, hopefully the attention is in a place where their ability to pay attention is in a place where looking at math or English or the other subjects that they study, they can be a little bit more focused.
So when they're going through this process, what have you seen as results academically of allowing the young students to go through this process and then reengage in the classroom?
So not only us, but there have been some fairly significant studies, including up your way, a study of 800 students in Oakland. And actually, that study, the level of mindfulness training is far less than what we engage in at Sea Change. But it was a 2-year study with controls and the like. But it really bears out the same thing that we notice in our experience, which is increased attention, increased ability to focus, and then what we haven't gotten into. But is a big part of the mindfulness, is increased self-compassion, self-care, and ability to relate with others. And so we found all those things in it. And, you know, those things are all very helpful in terms of being successful academically.
Okay. Folks, we are speaking with John Alcock. His book is 40 Things I Wish I Told My Kids, Mindful Messages About Success, Happiness, Leather, Pickle, and the Use and Misuse of Imagination. You can check out his website at 40thingsiwishitoldmykids.com, or you can put in his name, and that's John Alcock, J-O-H-N-A-L-L-C-O-C-K, and you can find out more information about what he is got going on here. You know, John, you said earlier about, you know, preparing the kids to go into the cold water, and there might be a kid that's going like, oh, the water's going to be so cold, I won't be able to stand it, and the kid is actually worrying about being in the water. In your book, you say that, you know, sometimes those worries that we think about are just not real. Why is that?
Well, I make a much more strident proposition, I think, that I think the chapter title is 90% of her worries are wrong.
Are wrong, right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of set up to be worry warts mm-hmm. when you think about it. Our brains are really no different in structure than the brains that cave people had. Mm-hmm. And at that time, having a healthy overdose of fear and worry was necessary for survival. I mean, there's saber-toothed tigers, there's warring tribes, there's all kinds of dangers, any one of which could snuff you out. And so being built to have a high degree of fear of your environment, it was a healthy thing, mm-hmm. and arguably is why our species is still here, because of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there aren't very many saber-toothed tigers in San Diego, and warring tribes are far away, mm-hmm. But we still have that same setup, and so we treat the slightly higher credit card bill or the driver next to us on the road as the saber-toothed tiger or the warring tribe. And so we react in a very fearful manner to events that we really can't kill like we could a saber-toothed tiger mm-hmm. or a warring tribe. And worse than that, most of the events that we currently fear in our day-to-day lives are out of our imagination. They're in the future. And we can't possibly deal with those in the present moment. And mm-hmm. so the thing about fear that is very useful when there's a present danger is it raises your adrenaline, it raises your cortisol, it causes your attention to be focused on the subject of the fear. And if you're fighting a saber-toothed tiger or trying to escape a rattlesnake, which I did on a hike at Torrey Pines a couple of years ago, all of those things are extremely helpful. They, could, mm-hmm. they get your body energized. Or if a car is coming at you as you're crossing traffic, they're all very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. They're not helpful for the imagined credit card bill. Because your adrenaline goes up, your cortisol goes up, your focus is all on that, but you can't mm-hmm. do anything about it. Okay. And you can't get rid of it because it's in your imagination. So that's why I think we come with a setup that 90% of the things that we worry about are wrong because our system is sort of biased towards worry and being recognition of harmful events. But in our modern society, it's really not that way at all. There, many of them are come out of our imagination.
Okay. In your subtitle of the book, it is Mindful Messages About Success, Happiness, Leather, Pickles, and the Use and Misuse of Imagination. What does leather, pickles, and misuse of imagination have to do with it?
Well, we just talked a little bit about misuse of imagination, mm-hmm. right? Where we're using our imagination to imagine catastrophes that aren't likely to exist. So leather requires a very, very short story. So there was a time before the invention of shoes that a king had a son, a prince, and the prince went out walking outside of the palace, and he stubbed his toe on a rock and then came down hard on a root and caused his foot to be injured. And so the king got all upset about that and got a minister and said to his minister, get all of our troops and we're going to pick up every rock and every root on every path in the kingdom. And then we're going to keep picking them up so the paths will never have rocks and roots on them ever again, and my prince won't stub his toe or hurt his foot. Uh-huh. And the minister was pretty wise. He said, you know, we can't do that. There's too many paths. We don't know where we're going to go. And the rocks and roots will just reappear. We can't predict where they're going to come. What if we build some shoes, these things that are leather that we can put around the prince's feet to protect him as he goes around these various paths of life? And so he'll carry a level of protection with him. And so that's sort of what the analogy is to the way our West approaches approaches happiness and mindfulness. I mean, the way we typically approach life is let's go imagine every rock and root that might go in front of us and imagine ways to either avoid them or fix them in advance. And it creates a very anxiety-filled existence, and one that we can't possibly accomplish anyways, because some rocks and roots we can't fix, and we can't possibly anticipate all of them. Rather, mindfulness allows you to create a protective environment for you where you can take these external events and respond to them in a way where you can maintain your sanity as opposed to the way we normally allow external events to control our happiness. So that's leather.
Okay. And pickles?
So again, a little bit of a story. Say you go down in the morning, and it's a typical morning. You've got a couple of kids, and you're hurrying, rushing to get them out the door. And you're going to make them lunch, so you rush to the refrigerator, open the refrigerator, grab a jar of pickles, take it out, open it, hurriedly make their lunch using the pickles, and then you close the jar, but because you're in a hurry and you're not being mindful, the jar kind of is ajar. That is, the top doesn't go on quite right. So you put it back in the refrigerator. And so then the kids go off. Everything works out okay that day. A couple of days later, same thing happens. You come down. You go in. You're hurrying. The kids are late for school. You run in unmindfully to the refrigerator, grab the thing, pull it out, and it falls to the ground and smashes all over the floor. So now you hurriedly and unmindfully try to clean up the pickles, try to clean up the pickle juice, try to clean up the glass. You think you do. Get the kids off to school, go back to your ordinary business. 2 days later, same thing. You run down in the morning, you're going to make lunch, you're barefoot, and guess what? You step on the glass that you missed because you were cleaning up the pickles, the broken pickle bottle in a hurry a couple of days before. Okay, so that's the general story. And it really is a description of what is typically referred to as karma, right? Your present moment intentions and actions will affect your situation. Your past intentions and actions will carry forward to affect your current situation. But you always have a chance to change. You always have a chance to do it differently. So in the example I just gave you, there were three opportunities to exercise mindfulness, and you would not have ended up in the emergency room. Any one of those opportunities to exercise mindfulness would have kept you out of the emergency room. But each time, the intention was, instead of being mindful, to hurry. The result of the intention was something that you didn't want, And the ultimate impact of that was injury to you in a pretty serious fashion. Mm-hmm. So that gives you both sides of the karma coin. One is our past intentions and actions will have a bearing on our current circumstance, but also, and more importantly, possibly, we always have an opportunity to change our intentions and actions. We always get a redo in life, is another way to say it. So that's pickles.
Okay. Well, in your book, you talk about actions spring from intentions, and actions make us aware of intentions.
Right.
How do we set the intention, or should we?
Well, to my mind, that's a very important thing, and that's where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness allows us a space where we can choose our intention, as opposed to having the intention delivered to us by our reaction to an external environment. So, look, you don't do anything without an intention. You have to have an intention to act and do anything. Sometimes we act out of automaticity. That is, there's an automatic habit that's driving what we're doing, and we don't even realize it. And so with mindfulness, you can reduce your reliance on habit and instead make your behaviors conform with wisely selected intention.
Okay. It's interesting that you can do that because, you know, recently in the news we've had the shooting down in Florida and those young adults, because I call them young adults, not kids, they decided that they were going to do something about it. You know, they were sick and tired of the way that things were. And one of the chapters in your book is complaining and blaming are not skillful, but taking a stand is. So talk to us more about that. What's galvanizing all these children today to say, you know, no, I'm tired of the old BS, and that's truly bullshit, not belief system, and we want something new.
Yeah, so that's the second part of it, taking a stand, which is really a powerful, appropriate thing. Complaining and blaming are not very helpful, and it's very common in our culture. I mean, the example that gave rise to that chapter was I go to the gym a lot, and there's a woman who goes there who it was on a treadmill frequently next to me. And basically, she was complaining about her husband's boss. And one year she complained that the guy was working her husband too hard. And the next year she complained that that he wasn't working him hard enough and they didn't make enough money to take a fancy vacation. But in either case, here she is telling me, someone who has no control over the situation whatsoever, about circumstances that she didn't like without any opportunity or intent to affect a change in the situation. And so it's a very, very bad mental habit that people have where they complain about things in their current situation. Mm-hmm. But they don't do it with an effort to change the situation. They do it just to elicit a poor me response out of people around them. And it just gets them into a mental habit of being a victim, frankly. And that doesn't get anybody anywhere. But the example you gave of the young adults is the exact opposite, right? It's believing in something and communicating that belief to people who have a meaningful role in potentially changing that. That's a very healthy and positive activity. Not one that I would call complaining. I would call it constructively building.
Okay. So if you're calling it constructively building, and that eventually would lead to freedom, correct? What we would consider freedom?
Well, I would consider it to be positive change.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. Going back to the children and going to the beach, because I mean that vision is just stuck in my mind. Being at the beach, getting in the water, coming out, practicing mindfulness. What have you noticed regarding doing that and the children's health and attendance in school?
Oh yeah, we have virtually perfect attendance.
Mm-hmm.
Virtually perfect attendance.
And is that because everybody wants to go to the beach every day, or what?
Well, it's I mean, there's a lot of reasons. There are other things about the school that are interesting. It's cross-aged in its learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's very low student-teacher ratio. It's a collaborative environment. It's a very, very caring and concern-filled environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a welcoming place to be. And also, I think it's a very positive environment for students succeeding, and students feel like they're succeeding. And you know, there's nothing like motivating kids. Success really delivers motivation, and motivation delivers attendance.
Okay, so I want to switch gears a moment and talk about the F word, and that's failure, because in your book, you have the belief system that I do, that failure just means that, you know, you tried something new, it didn't work out as you anticipated, but, you know, you opened and learned. So how can, and I think this is for the adults and the kids, because as adults, we think failure is bad and we don't want to see our kids fail. We'll do anything to stop them from failing and learning that lesson. How can we switch that energy for an adult to, no, I didn't fail, I learned something new, and then pass that same lesson on to our children?
Yeah, so that's actually one of my favorite chapters,
mm-hmm.
and it starts with one of my favorite quotes. I didn't make any mistakes. I just now know 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb. And that's from Thomas Edison.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, somebody said to him, how possibly could you have kept up your will? You worked 3 years on doing this act of trying to make a light bulb, and you failed every single time. How possibly could you keep up your effort? And he responded with the quote that I just said, which is totally in line with what you're saying. That mm-hmm. is, each one of those individual experiments created a positive piece of learning. And as long as you view events, as long as you choose wisely in the events that you engage in, you're going to learn something about yourself, about life, about how to do something from the event, even if it didn't work out, as you point out, exactly the way you wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we try to do at Sea Change, and what I've tried to do with my kids, is to look at really any challenge or event that you're approaching in life in that way. And there's a lot of positive benefits to viewing things that way.
Okay. Now, I absolutely love this chapter. Actually, it was the first chapter that I looked at when I reviewed the book because it caught my eye, and that is, don't treat the present moment like it's a shabby hotel room.
I don't know if that's my favorite chapter, but it's my favorite chapter title.
Mm-hmm. So what's the shabby hotel room? Because, I mean, when I go, and this is no disrespect to any of the hotel chains out there, but when I go to a hotel, that's interesting. When I go to a hotel, I camp out at the Hilton. That's like the lowest I'm willing to go. So what's a shabby hotel room, and how does that interplay with what we're talking about?
Well, it's the way most of us live, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of us live treating the present moment like a shabby motel room, like a crappy place that we're stuck in and that we have to be, and which is unenjoyable. And we're just using it as a way station to get somewhere else. And that's the way most of us treat the present moment. Most of us spend a lot of our time in the future, either in fantasies or in planning or worrying about how our plans aren't going to work out, or in the past about ruminations about why we should have or shouldn't have done this or that. Now, sure, there's nothing wrong with looking at the past, as we just talked about with the failure thing, and learning from it. And there's nothing wrong with planning. Planning is a very, very smart activity. But we spend way too much time in the past or in the future. And when you really think about it, there's no way you can find happiness in either of those places because they don't exist.
Right.
They only exist in your imagination. The only thing we have is the present moment. And so don't treat it like a shabby motel room. Occupy it, and as my, I think the next few chapters talk about, if you occupy it well enough, it's actually a fabulous place with a penthouse view, but you've got to occupy it that way.
Okay. I want to talk about the other F word, and that's forgiveness. So many people find it difficult to forgive themselves, and to forgive others. How does forgiveness and compassion play into the energy of mindfulness?
It's huge. And so, you know, if you go back to the definition that I used for mindfulness, it's paying attention to your present moment experience internally and externally without judgment. And it's without judgment, it's the without judgment part that brings in the compassion and the forgiveness. Without that, we constantly lead a life of being aversive to our present moment experience. And compassion is a huge element of mindfulness and self-care. And so the quote that is at the beginning of the forgiveness chapter is from the Buddha, and it's a great quote. It's, you know, it's like you're holding a hot coal and it's burning you. And you think that's somehow hurting the person that you're thinking about. Forgiveness is releasing the hot coal. So, you know, I used to think of forgiveness as something that you do for other people. Actually, compassion and forgiveness are two of the things that can have the most immediate positive impact on your own mind state. It can virtually eliminate anger and frustration. The two can't coexist in your mind at the same time.
That's very true. So when you are in the energy of forgiving, how does one forgive themselves if they, you know, feel that there's a need because they did something that they consider as horrible, they just can't seem to get past it or want to release it? So how can they set the energy so that they can clear their conscience, if you will, clear their soul energy so that they can move forward?
Right. It's a very tricky situation. And there's one of the chapters on separating your intrinsic self-worth and value from your behaviors. And to me, that's absolutely critical. Our behaviors are not going to be perfect. That's what being a human being is having behaviors that are not perfect.
Yeah, we're here to learn.
Yeah. However, that has nothing to do with your intrinsic value or your intrinsic self-worth. And thinking that it does actually makes it more difficult to change the behaviors. When you really realize that your intrinsic value and self-worth are independent of any of your behaviors, good or bad, it's much easier to release the unhealthy or unskillful behaviors. Just like you throw out an old sweater that has too many holes in it and isn't useful for you anymore. When you consider the behaviors as being part of yourself and part of your value and necessary for a positive value, that's when they're hard to change.
Okay. I want to talk to you about something that's not covered in your book that I remember, but it may have been, and that's clutter and mindfulness. Because I've found in my practice that when someone has a cluttered home, cluttered space, cluttered life, it seems very difficult for them to get into the space of mindfulness. What are your thoughts regarding that?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. You're right. That isn't directly covered anywhere in the book. That's really interesting. So I would say that it goes back to having intention and all of those things that are floating around are unnecessary for following through on wise intentions. And they're not helpful in selecting wise intentions. They're there, for some other reason. But I'd have to think about that more. That deserves a chapter.
Okay.
Let me write one.
Next book.
Yeah. No, that's really good.
Yeah, well, I just noticed that, when things are cluttered, whether it's your mind or even your space, well, first of all, if your space is cluttered, it tends to keep you out of mindfulness, or at least me out of mindfulness, because I'm looking at something, oh, I got that the other day, or, oh, I got this plant, but I want another plant to go with it, so I'm either past or the future, and, I'm not here appreciating what I have right here in front of me right now. So how is happiness in our hands regarding mindfulness?
So the way I look at happiness, it's being in a state of peace and contentment that isn't dependent on external conditions.
Okay.
And so that's where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness comes in such that you can keep your balance and your equanimity and a positive attitude, even when the stock market's going down or even when you're sitting in frustrated traffic. And so the happiness is truly in your hands and in your mind because our experience of life is created by the external events and our response to them. And while we don't always have control, and in fact sometimes very little control over external events, we always have control over our response to them. And therein lies the secret of being able to be happy despite what the world brings.
Okay. John, we're almost up with our time.
Cool.
What words of wisdom, did you say Cole?
Well, the reason I said so it flew by. I mean,
okay. Okay, I was like, cool, let's go. What words of wisdom would you like to leave with our audience tonight?
Yeah, all I'd like to say is the purpose of the book is to introduce mindfulness to people who have no significant background in it, and I would encourage people to take it up and try it, and try learning more about it, and try practicing it, because no moment spent in mindfulness is a wasted moment.
Exactly. Well, folks, we've been speaking with John Alcock. He is the author of 40 Things I Wish I Told My Kids, Mindful Messages About Success, Happiness, Leather, Pickles, and the Use and Misuse of Imagination. You can check out his website, and that is 40thingsiwishihadtoldmykids.com, or his name, John Alcock. johnnycock.com, and that's johnnaolcock.com. And you can also check out a school, because it seems like a really neat place. If I was a young mother and living in San Diego, that is something that I would definitely check out. So I want to thank John and the audience for being with me tonight as we collectively get over it and embrace mindfulness. The divine in me honors the divine in you. When you're ready to live a more balanced life, give me a call. Intuitive consultations, 30 minutes or longer, are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself and make that call. 888-240-6057. And remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of being mindful. Abundant blessings, light and love to all. Namaste.